Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Kentucky could get its first Muslim lawmaker if one candidate is successful.
A man with a foreign accent, Muslim name, walks into Kentucky State Capitol, files his application. Nobody says, oh, you can't do that.
So what do folks in Bobtown, Pennsylvania really think of those pizza gift certificates?
Maybe that's kind of why everybody was so surprised at the reaction to the pizza thing, because we're just used to that.
Pickens, West Virginia celebrates the maple syrup harvest.
I mean, so many people come back to help from all over the country, and they bring their kids with them.
And some West Virginia rocket boys put their skills to a test.
Well, I'm learning how to build these rockets, and I like the 3D printer a lot. I think that's pretty cool.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Kentucky is among several states this year targeted for a Republican takeover at the state level. The GOP is hoping to win a majority in the House, a chamber currently controlled by Democrats 54-46. But with all eyes on the House, there's a different battle brewing in the state's Republican-run Senate. As Kentucky Public Radio's Jonathan Meter reports, one candidate is testing to see if the Commonwealth is ready for its first Muslim lawmaker.
A man with a foreign accent, Muslim name, walks into Kentucky State Capitol, files his application. Nobody says, oh, you can't do that.
It's about 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon in winter-swept downtown Louisville. Sadiq Malik, a Democrat running for Kentucky's 36th state Senate district, picks slowly with his fork at a plate of chicken shawarma, reminiscing about filing his election papers earlier in the year.
In my country of my birth, if a non-Muslim had walked into the election office and filed his or her papers for the office of president or prime minister or something, they would have arrested him for breaking the law. That was what touched my heart. That's beautiful. That was a beautiful experience right there.
If elected, Malik would become the first practicing Muslim elected to the Kentucky General Assembly. Malik immigrated from his native Pakistan over 40 years ago as a teenager, moving with his wife to Canada to pursue his studies in computer science, bounced around the Midwest until finally settling in Louisville, where he started a family. He says he started taking graduate courses in political science at the University of Louisville as a joke. Now, he's 2 courses shy of a master's degree and is putting the finishing touches on his thesis about Muslim subculture in America. The father of college-aged children, Malik reminisces about his own father, who grew wheat and cotton on a farm in Pakistan's Punjab province. Malik's father inspired him at an early age with stories of America's icons, including one from Kentucky.
Lincoln, the word Lincoln was a trigger for him. You say, when Lincoln around him, that he'll forget everything he was talking about or doing. He just start talking about Lincoln and America. So you had to be careful around him. Don't utter the word Lincoln.
Muslims are a minority in America and in Kentucky, with a population of about 11,000 concentrated in Louisville. But their presence is nearly non-existent in elected government.
The Muslim community, and nor can any community, but the Muslim community particularly, cannot remain silent, must be engaged in the political process, must get involved. We must come together with other people of the community to talk about the importance of civil and human rights in this period of time in which our rights have been so fragile.
That's Minnesota Representative Keith Ellison in 2006, after becoming the first practicing Muslim elected to the U.S. Congress. He's since been joined by Andrew Carson of Indiana. Malik echoes Ellison's sentiment, saying his candidacy will in part be to educate the state about the role that Muslims can have in civic life, and to dispel rumors about Muslims in general. But since 9/11, those rumors have run rampant and have even influenced policy. A handful of states have passed laws aimed at curbing a perceived Islamic infiltration of government. Currently, Kentucky GOP Representative Kim King has filed legislation that would prohibit Kentucky's courts from basing their decisions on foreign law, including the Muslim Sharia.
In New York State and in Michigan State, judges are deciding court cases based on foreign law, European law, Middle Eastern law, but not citing U.S. law, and it hasn't been a problem in Kentucky yet, but I want to make sure that we continue to use U.S. law to determine court cases in Kentucky.
But Malik has other problems, too. Daniel Logsdon, chairman of the Kentucky Democratic Party, says he's never heard of the candidate. And to compound matters, he's running against Julie Rocky Adams, an incumbent Republican in the state House of Representatives with name recognition and support from her party. The largely middle-class to affluent district affords Rocky another edge. There are nearly 1,000 more Republican voters registered in the district than there are Democrats, reflecting a larger trend toward a GOP advantage across the state. Sadiq says this is more of a disadvantage than his personal background.
Just because a lot of Republicans in my district does not mean they dislike me because of my Muslim background. They might dislike me because I'm a Democrat, and most Republicans and Democrats have their work cut out for themselves. They don't agree with each other's policies. So I'm not really worried that my Muslim background and my being, having a Middle Eastern sounding name, Muslim sounding name, will be a big issue.
And his political views, much of them outlined in a column he wrote for the Daily Courier Journal newspaper, put him at odds with the vast majority of Kentucky's lawmakers.
I would push for universal health care, tell you the truth. And that is what President Obama wanted to do, but he ended up diluting his legislation so much that it turned into something that God knows what it is. Even Obama doesn't know what it is.
He also supports marriage equality, currently a hot topic in Kentucky politics due to a recent federal ruling that overturned portions of the state's 2004 constitutional ban on same-sex marriage, one of many views that he says strains his relationship with other Muslims.
I am just in fully support of all human beings being able to do whatever their heart desires, whatever they want to do, as long as, of course, it's not to hurt somebody else. Then, of course, we have laws to protect against that. Yes, I'm absolutely in favor of that. I have absolutely all gay marriages, gay people, they are just as human beings as you and I, they deserve equality and protection. Absolutely.
Despite the odds, Malik is optimistic he will make history.
Donald Trump is not going to come here and ask me for my birth certificate because it's in a language that he probably does not know. This will be an election campaign based on issues, and that's the way democracy works, and that's the way it's going to work in 36.
Spoken like a true American politician. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Meter.
West Virginia Governor Earl Ray Tomlin has signed a budget that dips into millions of dollars in state reserves. While Tomlin approved next year's budget, he vetoed nearly $67 million in spending. Tomlin also limited use of the state's rainy day fund to cover a projected shortfall of $100 million. The proposal passed by lawmakers last week would have taken nearly $150 million from the fund. The budget includes raises for public employees, including across-the-board raises for teachers and school service personnel. House Democratic lawmakers opposed increasing cigarette sales and other taxes. Governor Tomlin also signed legislation that saves a portion of West Virginia's severance tax on energy and extraction industries to finance infrastructure needs and teacher raises. The so-called Future Fund skims 3% from all tax revenues on the oil, gas, mineral, and timber industries. The tax revenue can only be sent to savings if the state's main reserve, that rainy day fund, is more than 13% of the general fund. The budget is balanced without the use of the rainy day fund, and there are no mid-year hiring freezes. Senate President Jeff Kessler is the bill's sponsor. Tomlin said the Future Fund can break the state's cycle of poverty by investing income from its prized resources. The Rainy Day Fund is the topic of this essay by Rick Wilson, director of the American Friends Service Committee's West Virginia Economic Justice Project.
When I was a little kid, my grandmother would sometimes give me a whole dollar, which in those days seemed like real money to me. She always said she dug it up from the pig pen. Her farm at the time didn't have any pigs in it, but I knew where the old pen was. I imagine she went out there with a shovel and dug for money anytime she needed some. If you think about it, that's kind of what we did with our economy in Appalachia, and especially my state of West Virginia, for the last 100 years. We've gotten by digging things out of the ground, whether it was coal, gas, oil, or other minerals. And the process has often been much more dangerous and destructive than anything a grandmother could do with a shovel. There have been some problems with that. For one thing, every time you take something out of the ground, there's that much less in it. And if you measure wealth by what's underground, we get a little poorer every time we dig it up. And when it's gone, it's gone. Along the way, there are cycles of boom and bust with the accent on bust. Most of the economic gain is a one-time thing like a sugar high, and most of the profits leave the state while the damage and costs stay here. This isn't unique to Appalachia. Several years ago, Columbia University's Jeffrey Sachs and a team of economists looked at nearly 100 countries and found that most of those that relied heavily on extraction had major problems. This year, however, West Virginia's legislature took a step to change all that. By a large margin, a bill was passed to create a future fund. This is intended to be a trust fund from a portion of severance taxes that'll build up over the years and be prudently invested. The idea is that the interest from it could eventually provide a permanent source of wealth from our non-renewable resources, one that could be used in years to come for infrastructure, economic development, or education. Many other mineral states, mostly out west, have done this, as have some countries. However, I think this is the first example for Appalachia. The bill wasn't perfect. In fact, I think it needs work for it to really take off, but it's a start. Too bad we didn't do this a long time ago. While we don't get to hit rewind for the last 100 years, we can try to make sure that we do better in the 21st century than we did in the 20th. That might be something for other parts of Appalachia to consider as well.
Rick Wilson is a native and lifelong resident of West Virginia. He directs the American Friends Service Committee's West Virginia Economic Justice Project. He holds BA and MA degrees from Marshall University and has taught sociology for Marshall and WVU Tech. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. A new report from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting has found that a biomass plant that's planned for eastern Kentucky may not bring the clean energy and economic rewards its developers have promised. And as Kentucky Public Radio's Erica Peterson reports, there's another potential roadblock for the plant. It needs a lot of water, and the city says it won't be able to supply the facility.
It's a cold winter day, and my colleague Ralph Dunlop and I are driving around aimlessly on top of a former strip mine in Perry County. The site hasn't been used for mining in a while. Now it's the site of an industrial park. But what Ralph and I are looking for is slightly off the beaten path.
Should we hang a right?
Yeah, hang a right. This is it. It is fairly anticlimactic. A 30-foot by 30-foot concrete slab off a rutted dirt road. This is where a company called EcoPower plans to build a biomass plant.
I mean, pretty much we're standing on a concrete slab in absolutely the middle of nowhere.
Can we say that?
Yeah.
We're in an industrial park, which has a few other businesses in it. This is the home of the proposed EcoPower plant, and this is all of the construction that's been done so far.
Standing on the slab, there are panoramic views of surface mining in several directions, signs of the coal mining that's fueled this region for generations. If it's built, this biomass plant will be a first, both for Perry County and for the Commonwealth. Technically, biomass is a form of renewable energy. These power plants burn living materials that aren't living anymore, things like trees and wood pellets and even specially grown crops. The heat from the burning is turned into electricity. But contrary to EcoPower officials' argument that the project will be beneficial for the region's economy, documents suggest that promised jobs may be inflated and electricity rates will rise. There are also questions about the plant's effect on the local environment. Even though it's renewable, biomass technology still relies on natural resources, namely trees. And Hazard City officials tell us they have another concern, water. Biomass plants need a lot of water, as much as a coal-fired power plant. EcoPower officials estimate they need anywhere from 50,000 to 100,000 gallons of water a day. And Hazard officials say there's no way the city can provide the power plant with all the water it needs.
It's impossible, I think.
Nan Gorman is the mayor of Hazard. She says the city's water supply has already run short once this winter, and if she has to prioritize, getting water to the new biomass plant wouldn't be a main concern.
Do you have a general opinion about this plant?
Most people are for it because of the employment. Anything, they think anything that we get in our industrial park would be good. And I'm all in favor of that, but I question the water.
This is the water she's talking about. The North Fork of the Kentucky River, running through downtown Hazard, supplies water to the entire county. The county can only legally draw 5 million gallons of water from the river every day. And as it is, the city's water treatment plant is having trouble keeping up with current demand. The treatment plant was built more than a half century ago and sits just outside downtown. We walk in. The roar is deafening, and there's no one around.
Can we just walk into the city water plant?
Finally, we find Kenneth Couch, the city's plant manager. We go into his small office, where there's a TV blaring. Couch smokes Winston's and explains the inner workings of the city's water system, but he doesn't want to be recorded.
I'll talk to you, but I don't want to be on no damn TV.
Couch has been at the plant for 35 years and has been in charge for the last 15 years or so. He says this is the first he's heard of the Echo Power Plant. And he doesn't think the city can come anywhere close to providing 100,000 gallons of water a day to the plant either. But documents show the company has a plan B. In two siting documents, Echo Power officials say they would also consider getting water from the Hollybush impoundment, a water source located nearby on a former mine site. But that's problematic too. Records show Hollybush can hold 20.5 million gallons of water. That's a lot, and could potentially supply the Echo Power Plant, at least sometimes. But it's also likely that during dry seasons, the Echo Power Plant could find itself without a reliable supply of water, and thus no electricity. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Erica Peterson.
To read more about the Echo Power Biomass Plant in Hazard, visit WFPL.org and search biomass. Bobtown is having its 15 minutes of fame. The small town in southwest Pennsylvania has been fodder for late-night comedians, Twitter wits, and anti-fracking activists. First in February, a Chevron natural gas well near Bobtown exploded, killing a worker. Then the company responded by giving community residents free coupons to Bobtown Pizza. This struck Chevron's critics as outrageous. As State Impact Pennsylvania's Katie Culinary reports, some Bobtown residents have a different response to the company's gesture.
I first met Joanne and Edward Harrington the day after a fire broke out at the Chevron natural gas well site just up the hill from their home near Bobtown. The roar of the blaze woke them up at night. A worker on the site was still missing. A month later, I'm back in their kitchen, and Joanne's showing me a free coupon they got from the company for a large pizza and a 2-liter soda from a local shop.
We haven't had time to use it, but we're going to use it because they're not open on Sundays.
Photos of coupons just like this one have gone viral. More than 12,000 people from the Netherlands to San Francisco have signed a petition demanding Chevron apologize for insulting residents like the Harringtons. Even Stephen Colbert has taken his shots at the so-called Chevron pizza scandal.
So tonight, I'm giving a tip of the hat to Chevron. It's the least they could do. Literally, I think it is the least they could possibly do.
Back in the Harrington's kitchen, the whole business isn't registering as scandal.
I don't see a thing wrong with that pizza deal. You, Joanne?
I just thought they was just showing their appreciation us standing by them with all the trucking, with all the traffic, with all the noise and stuff.
Chevron says that's exactly why they bought the coupons. Chevron's critics see it as one of many companies in Pennsylvania's history that have swooped in to take natural resources with little regard for communities. They don't see why it should get a pass in this case. But in this part of Pennsylvania, the relationship between companies and communities is more complicated. Down the road from the Harrington's house is an active coal mine. A month ago, the flames and smoke from the Chevron well pad could be seen rising from a ridge just above this mine. Decades before natural gas drilling, coal was king. In the early 1900s, Bobtown became a thriving coal patch on the border of West Virginia. Most of the men worked in the Shanapan mine run by Jones and Lachlan Steel. The company owned most of the land in town and built houses for the workers and their families.
There we go.
Bonnie Ganser runs the local beauty salon. She's cutting Kathy Shabanik's hair. Both of their fathers and Kathy's husband were coal miners. Chibanek remembers the sound of the whistle that would blow to call the firemen when there was an accident in the mines.
It could have been a fire, it could have been an auto accident, or it could have been the mine. And more than likely,
it was a coal mine.
It was the coal mine.
The mine closed in 1993. Now, many of the workers' houses sit abandoned, as does the old company store. Some families have moved away, while others travel to West Virginia to work. But those who've stayed in Bobtown still savor the rituals of a close-knit company town.
A lot of traditions.
Yes.
Food.
The foods, everything. The fish fries every
Friday. Which still go on at our fire hall out here.
Food is also part of the rites of grief in Bobtown. Someone dies, and neighbors bring dinner.
Maybe that's kind of why everybody was so surprised at the reaction to the pizza thing, because we're just used to that. If something happens, you give people food. I never looked at it as a negative thing, you know?
But not everyone in Bobtown sees it that way. Julianne Wozniak says she was angry at Chevron for giving out pizza coupons when the company could have done something more permanent for the entire community.
Like, we'd be satisfied with pizza coupons, for God's sakes. After the major disruption they caused for 2 days, and we breathed all that toxic air for over a week.
Wozniak's distrust of big energy companies like Chevron runs in her blood. Her grandfather helped organize the mine workers' unions in this part of Greene County. He let them meet in the corner store slash bar he set up on the outskirts of Bobtown. While she supports the petition against Chevron, Wozniak believes the media's reaction distracts from the fact that a young worker died in the explosion.
I think an equal attention should be paid to worker safety. I mean, that was what union organizing was about back in my grandfather's day, assuring that workers didn't die at a prodigious rate in the mines. And here we have this new industry, and it's the same old, same old.
The Greene County Coroner's Office is still working to identify the remains of 27-year-old Ian McKee. McKee leaves behind a fiance who's pregnant with his child. A lawyer for the family says the county still has not been able to issue a death certificate. Meanwhile, the spotlight continues to shine on Bobtown. This is the famous Bobtown pizza.
This is it.
Last week, producers from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart descended on the shop where Chevron bought the 100 gift certificates. Co-owner Bill Souden says so far only 12 residents have come in to claim their free meals. His business partner Brian Scritchfield doesn't get what all the fuss has been about.
We think it's funny, you know, this is such a big deal out of just us doing what we do, serve pizza.
Katie Culinary, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia on a multimedia, data-driven reporting project covering the Commonwealth's energy economy. Backyard and neighborhood ice rinks have long been a part of winters in Canada and the northern U.S., but with a warming climate, that could be changing. A group of Canadian scientists are asking backyard ice rink owners in North America to engage in a little citizen science by answering the question, were you able to skate today? The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsoppel has the story.
After school, one day in February, Mike Gordon escorts his daughters, Rebecca and Dora, onto an ice rink that's a little unusual. It's in the front yard of their Pittsburgh home.
I think the middle is going to be better, guys, because there's some snow on the outside around the edges.
One reason the Gordons bought this house was because it had a nice flat front yard, perfect for a DIY ice rink. When I visited, 8-year-old Dora in pink earmuffs said she likes that she could come out and skate whenever she wants.
How long can you stay out here before you have to go back inside?
I don't know, until I'm freezing.
The surface of the 20 by 40 feet rink is kind of crunchy and uneven today, since it's been sleeting. Gordon levels some rough patches for the girls by scraping it with a hockey stick.
The best conditions are when it's really, really cold and really clear and not a lot of precipitation, because then it just freezes and it has that sort of glass, you know, glass smoothness to it, and that's when you have really the best skating.
The wood frame goes up around Thanksgiving, and when the weather gets cold enough, Gordon fills the plastic-lined rectangle with water from a garden hose. The family and their neighbors skate and play hockey here mid-December into February or March.
The way I figure it around here is if we get 10 skates in during winter, I'm very happy.
Last year, they only got 2 or 3 skates in. The year before that, none at all. That's exactly the kind of information that a team of Ontario-based scientists is looking for. Last winter, they launched RinkWatch, an online crowdsourced map of ice skating rinks all over North America.
We were hoping that maybe by the end of the winter, we might have 50 or 100 rinks participating. We had that by the end of the first week.
Robert McClemon of RinkWatch says 1,000 rinks were logged by the end of last winter, a quarter of those in the U.S. RinkWatch asks users to register their rinks by location, no personal information required. The only other thing they want to know is if it's skatable. RinkWatch is testing the theory that global warming is going to make it more difficult to have an outdoor rink. McClemon says the media tends to focus on threatened polar bears or Arctic ice disappearing.
Those examples don't really resonate with your average household here in North America who aren't going to encounter polar bears in their lifetime.
He says if the climate dampens our ability to skate outdoors, it might help make that connection. McClemon says they'll need a lot of data over many years to tell a larger story about climate change, and not just about weather variability year to year. And they've created a forum so users can share their ice conditions, rink-building expertise, and skating stories.
Older generations are saying, well, when we were young, we would build a rink and we could skate on it from, you know, the end of November right through till Easter. And you just can't do that today.
McClemon says it's begun a dialogue between generations about the quality of the outdoor environment. Back in Pittsburgh, as Mike Gordon watches his daughters and the neighborhood kids skate around his rink, he says he feels that tug of the past. His dad, a youth hockey league pioneer in Pittsburgh, started the ice rink tradition in his family.
I really do believe it was something he gave to us that was a gift that I want to pass on to my kids, and I hope that it kind of continues through the generations. I know that sounds a little sentimental or whatever, but it's true. It really is.
Climate forecasts predict wetter, warmer winters for Pennsylvania, but Gordon hopes there will be many more skatable days like this in the future. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsoppel.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. It's ginseng season in Appalachia. The History Channel featured a new show this year that focused on ginseng in the region. There's no official word if season two is in the works, and while some fans are hoping that there will be a second season, West Virginia Public Radio's Glennis Board reports other people are hoping the show will just go away.
Ginseng's the most beautiful plant in the mountains because it turns into money. People will steal for it, steal it. Some bitch shoot you and kill you over it.
Well, that's how History, formerly the History Channel, is selling its show Appalachian Outlaws. It's another reality-esque, loosely unscripted TV show brought by the same network that airs American Pickers and Vikings. While many viewers are intrigued by the characters and drama, others think the show is downright irresponsible, and people who hunt ginseng, known as sangers, and other experts agree that there are plenty of inaccuracies. Carrie Johnson is a sanger from McDowell County who's been hunting ginseng for years. He says some of the big money shout out in the show for freshly dug sang is misleading.
Anybody paid $550 for a pound of daggone sang, it's green. They got more damn money than they got cents.
Big day, big day. We got to come up with 200 pounds of fresh ginseng. That's a lot of fresh for 1 week, but the prices I'm paying on this stuff, we're all going to make money.
Dry is worth a lot more than green. I sold, like I said, a pound and 2 ounces. The last that I sold was $978. And a guy up there bought in a pound of green, wasn't nothing, $250.
He also has his doubts about how much ginseng some of the characters are actually harvesting.
Yeah, they going out digging 5 pound in a day or so. That's bull. It took me 2 months just to find 4 pound.
You know, there's such an amazing story to be told, and instead they're glorifying individuals going out and poaching on public lands, on private lands.
That's Susan Leopold, executive director of the United Plant Savers.
That doesn't really serve any purpose other than trying to portray negative behavior to get ratings. I think it sets a terrible precedent.
Her organization's mission is to protect native medicinal plants of the United States and Canada. Together with American Herbal Products Association, she sent a letter to A&E Networks, which owns History, imploring them to correct the record by including additional conservation information for viewers. But let me catch you up. What is ginseng? Wild American ginseng has been harvested from North America since the 1700s. Demand for the plant's root comes from Asia, where plants like ginseng have been used medicinally for over 2,500 years. And yes, we're talking serious demand. A pound of quality dried ginseng can easily sell for $400 to $900. But that's wild ginseng, or wild simulated, which means it's been grown under watchful eyeballs in forested areas where it would naturally grow, if it had the chance. The upshot is that the plant is at risk. It's been declining in numbers, and it faces a lot of threats. In fact, it's listed alongside things like ivory and shark and mahogany on CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, an international agreement between governments which exists to protect species against over-exploitation through international trade.
There's a variety of different pressures on American ginseng. Some of it is certainly due to collection pressures, but there are also other types of pressures, both man-made and natural.
That's Eric Burkhart. He's the Plant Science Program Director at Shavers Creek Environmental Center at Penn State University. He's been studying ginseng for over a decade.
So this is listed under CITES, as are a number of other products, including animal parts. And I find it difficult to believe that there would be a show that the History Channel or any other major U.S. network would choose to film that glorifies the poaching and killing of animals so that the ivory can be traded into China or wherever it's going to end up and portray it as some sort of entertainment value.
Burkhart and Leopold are both disappointed by the show. They say history missed an opportunity to educate viewers by focusing solely on entertainment. They and many academics and conservationists are worried that the culture of flouting rules and regulations will tear at the fabric of their work to conserve and preserve the plant and the forest that enables the plant's existence.
The silver lining here is that it has generated a lot of interest in American ginseng, for better or for worse. And a lot of the positive interest has been coming in through people contacting me for information, not only about collecting, but more importantly, in my mind, people are interested in growing the plant, figuring out how they can establish a patch on their own forest lands and grow it for income and for conservation.
No word on a reply to Leopold's letter to A&E Network on spreading the word about conservation, inspiring concern, and promoting sustainable practices. But hey, that's what PBS is for, right? For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
This is Inside Appalachia.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. About 800 people are expected at Marshall University in Huntington next weekend for the 37th annual Appalachian Studies Conference. Marshall University education professor and conference organizer Linda Spadig says the theme is known realities and imagined possibilities.
I guess the imagined possibilities, one of the things I hope comes from that part of the theme is giving a good bit of attention to Appalachian activism. What can we do to make a better future in Appalachia, not just in our scholarship, but in our community, in our roles in our communities?
Spadig says the Appalachian Studies Association, which hosts the conference, also wants more young people to be involved.
So we're not just valuing and respecting the long traditions of music and quilting and the foods and all that, but we're also paying attention to the diversity and good things and problems that exist in Appalachia today.
Interest in defining the region dates back to the late 1800s with Berea College President William G. Frost. Appalachian Studies Association President and Berea College Professor Chris Green says interest increased in the 1960s during President Johnson's War on Poverty.
Then in the 1970s, when there was also the rise of ethnic and racial awareness, there was also a sense of Appalachians being come together, too.
But Green says perceptions of Appalachia based on images created during the War on Poverty persist. He cites a story by ABC News anchor Diane Sawyer called A Hidden America, Children of the Mountains, as an example.
I just had students down from Vermont who asked me, they had come down to work with the Christian Appalachian Project, whose 50th year anniversary it is too, is Mountain Dew Mouth real? Which was something that happened on that 2020 show. And so those images are still out there, unfortunately.
Green points out the war on poverty has helped with building a foundation of infrastructure across the region that includes highways as well as water and sewer systems. He says the challenge now is building up the human capital.
I think a really good example of where we see a lot of that going on is with Create West Virginia, drawing together a group of disparate entrepreneurs from all over the state to get together and to think about the resources that are there that they can make amazing good things happen with and profitable businesses happen with as well.
The conference will offer sessions and research presentations. Topics range from exploring the coal industry, mountaintop removal mining and environmental concerns, to looking at healthcare needs and access, as well as literature, food, music, and gender issues. Green says one particularly timely presentation on Friday morning will explore the economic, cultural, and social conditions in the Carpathian Mountain region of Ukraine.
There's a saying that Jerry Williamson, who's the old editor of the Appalachian Journal, had, and he says, everybody's got one. And the one that everybody has is a place of raw resource extraction in the mountains. And that's true whether or not you're in Italy or whether or not you're in the Ukraine in the Carpathian Mountains. And as a result, these mountain areas are underdeveloped, oftentimes economically, and culturally quite different from the surrounding areas.
Conference organizer Linda Spadick says pre-registration is not required and walk-ins are welcome. She says thanks to a West Virginia Humanities grant, some of the events are also free and open to the public. The conference starts Friday morning and ends Sunday afternoon. Last weekend, the isolated Randolph County, West Virginia town of Pickens drew a couple thousand visitors to eat at the annual Maple Syrup Festival. About 45 gallons of fresh West Virginia maple syrup were consumed in 2 days during pancake breakfasts. Traveling 219's Roxy Todd recorded this story from those breakfasts at the American Legion Hall and at the live performance by the Nightcrawlers inside the Pickens Opera House.
I head down windy roads, over an hour's drive outside of Buchanan, to a little place called Pickens, West Virginia, which has a population of about 20 people. Normally, the town here is virtually empty. But today is the first day of the Pickens Maple Syrup Festival, and a grassy lot is filled with hundreds of cars on the site where the timber barons once landed their planes in Pickens. Like many, my first priority here is getting a taste of the maple syrup that was tapped in the last few weeks here in Pickens. At the door, I meet Debbie Morgan, who's selling tickets for buckwheat pancakes and sausage.
On a given a weekend of the festival between here and the school, because we serve at the school on Saturday, we usually serve around 2,000 pancake meals.
Debbie and her siblings have been some of the main organizers for the Maple Syrup Festival since it began in 1985. She was born and raised in Pickens, but like many of the event's organizers, she and her family moved away to Charleston and then to Buchanan to find work. In mid-March, dozens of people like Debbie returned to Pickens to help prepare and cook for the Maple Syrup Festival.
Back in the kitchen right now, there's people from Ohio, people from Pennsylvania, you know, all over, but it's people that come back to help.
The festival coincides with what are usually the most ideal conditions for tapping maple trees, as freezing temperatures at night, followed by warmer days, allow for the best tasting and the best flowing maple sap. The liquid sap is then processed into rich, thick syrup using a wood-burning sap evaporator. It can take as many as 50 gallons of liquid sap to reduce down to 1 gallon of syrup.
There are two syrup camps here, maple syrup camps. One is on the way to Elkins, and they sell their syrup here, but we actually buy the syrup for the breakfast from Mike Richter. It's up on the mountain. Yes, up above Pickens, off the Turkey Bone Road. We get it in 5 gallon containers, and we have at least probably anywhere from 40 to 50 gallons of syrup for the weekend.
Many still remember riding the final passenger train that left Pickens in 1958. During the timber boom, Pickens had 1,500 people living in the town. Today, there are about 20. And anyone who works commutes to Elkins, Mill Creek, or Buchanan.
There's not many people live here anymore. I mean, there's hardly anyone. Everyone that has lived here comes back. I mean, so many people come back to help from all over the country, and they bring their kids with them. The money that's made from the festival, we use it back into the buildings.
This past year, the Pickens Historical Society replaced a roof at the Community Craft House. The project was funded with money raised at past maple syrup festivals. But more than the money, says Debbie, it's the people who return to Pickens each year that continue to make this festival what it's become.
On our 25th festival, an older gentleman from Spencer, West Virginia, he came in and he said, "Honey, I want to tell you, I've been here for 25 years, meaning he'd been here every year. And I said, why do you come back? And he said, I look forward to this all winter. Then that almost makes me teary-eyed. And, you know, I'm like, wow, we got to keep doing this. Yeah.
Those who drive out to Pickens for the Maple Syrup Festival seem to because they love the place. But more than that, they love what the festival represents, survival. For many here, as it is throughout West Virginia, survival is synonymous with festival season.
And then tonight we have the ham and bean, and then we have the square dance, and that's kind of a wind down for us. And then we have to get up tomorrow morning and start all over again.
This story was produced by Roxy Todd of the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and AmeriCorps Vista. Visit traveling219.com. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Combat veterans who are hiking the Appalachian Trail as part of the Walk Off the War program are at the start of their six-month trek. The Appalachian Trail Conservancy in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, says it has again partnered with Warrior Hike for the program that supports returning combat veterans' transition to civilian life. Officials say the 2,100-mile hike gives veterans a chance to process their wartime experiences with others who have been through the same thing. This year's group began its trek this week along the Appalachian Trail, which stretches from Maine to Georgia. The program also has been expanded this year to include end-to-end hikes on the Continental Divide and the Pacific Crest National Scenic Trails. West Virginia has a rich history of young people involved in the science fields, many using rocket science to fulfill their dreams. Think writer Homer Hickam and his book Rocket Boys. Hickam's fascination with rockets as a child eventually led to a career as a NASA engineer. A group of students from North Central West Virginia is trying to follow in Hickam's footsteps, hoping a rocket they built will launch them to the very top. West Virginia Public Radio's Ben Aduccio has more.
There are five students in North Central West Virginia who are building a rocket to launch in the Team America Rocketry Challenge competition. This competition entails sending a rocket 825 feet into the air, which will hold two raw eggs inside of it. The rocket must come down within a certain time period, almost 50 seconds, and the eggs can't break. Simple, right? Well, actually, no. But a very special machine is helping these students. It's a three-dimensional printer housed at the National Aeronautics and Space Administration's facility in Fairmont. Student and team member Jack Thompson explains what the printer is doing.
I designed and sent to the printer an altimeter mount. An altimeter is used for calibrating how high your rocket has gone, determining by the change of pressure in the atmosphere. And it'll take about 4.5 hours to complete this entire altimeter mount. We're going to put it in our rocket we're working on building at the moment.
Thompson and I were standing 3 feet away from the printer while it was making this model, and it felt as if we were standing next to an oven. It's heating up to more than 200 degrees Celsius, but it's absolutely vital in giving these students a working model of parts for their rocket they will be launching. The students are using NASA software to basically design models of rockets with specific measurements, and then they can print off different parts with the printer. Student Luc Perret, the newest member of the team, says he loves working with it.
Well, I'm learning how to build these rockets, and I like the 3D printer a lot. I think that's pretty cool. And yeah, I think it's really cool that he just sort of invited us, that like we could come and just play around with it at any time. That's really amazing.
The team is called the Scienceers, and one person who is helping them is Todd Ensign, a NASA program manager for an education resource center. Ensign works with students all over the state who enter rocket competitions. He says West Virginia in recent years has seen a growth in interest in rocket competitions, and that's a very good thing.
Last year, we had 29 teams competing, and 5 of those teams, the first time ever in West Virginia's history, made it to the Nationals. They were in the top 100, the best 100 teams in the nation, and they got to go out to Washington, D.C. and compete. And some of those teams were right from here in Fairmont. We had 2 teams from North Marion High School, they did very well. We had, in fact, had Gilmer County High School make it to the 16th place in the nation.
Ensign believes the benefits of doing this kind of work are absolutely limitless.
And I personally believe that competitions like this provide a gateway for students to delve so much deeper than they ever could during their school studies, during the limited time they have to study science, and they really don't have engineering courses. They don't have an opportunity to use the type of software and tools that we have here, but they get to apply all of that and really dig deep.
Ensign gives some advice to the students.
The location of this line, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then it's 6.5 from the edge of this line to the center of the circle on the right side.
It's actually 2.5.
Yeah, 2.5.
The student Ensign is talking to is Caroline Thompson, Jack's sister. She says the students tried to win last year, but their rocket fell on a road, causing its eggs to crack. This time around, they are doing something different.
This year we have a foam case, I guess is how you want to say it, that we took a big piece of foam and we carved it out to fit the eggs. And so the eggs go in, one on each side. We tried bubble wrap in the beginning, but the bubble wraps was so big because we didn't have the small bubble wrap that it actually, we had to kind of pop the bubbles to get it to fit in the rocket, and then the eggs broke in the launch.
These students come from different backgrounds. Jack Thompson, for instance, he wants to be a ballet dancer. He's only 16, and he's receiving offers from different places for his services.
If you're a teenager and you don't think you're ever going to use math or science in your life, it's crazy how reality can kind of kick you back into gear and make you realize that everyone uses it at some point in their life.
The team must launch its rocket before the end of the month, and if its scores are strong, it can qualify for the national competition. That takes place in May in Virginia. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Fairmont.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, WHYY in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.